My name is Rick Spillane, and today I'm going to be telling you about the research I've been doing at the File Systems and Storage Lab at Stony Brook University. In the bottom right there, it's cut off a little bit. concerning enabling system transactions in standard VFS-based kernel. So the questions we're looking at in this work are, what is sort of the minimum amount of work we have to do to get a decent system transaction capable kernel? And I'll tell you what system transactions are in a second. And we have some static modification to the actual write-back thread and to some locking code in a previous prototype, but the amount of intrusive code is relatively low, and the rest of our code is sort of in the implementation of a relatively textbook logging module, which is a separate module. Our performance is decent. We get 35% overhead on top of what I predict to be sort of the an optimally implemented logging device based off of the standard design, compared to 104% overhead for an efficient user level alternative. So what is a system transaction? Well, you have some file system state foo, and a process comes along and it decides that it wants to make some modifications to the file system, but it wants to make a series of modifications, and it wants all the modifications to be applied or none of them to be applied. So it's going to begin a transaction, a system transaction. At this point, there becomes this new candidate state foo prime, which is sort of, if this transaction were to commit, then the file system state would become this new state foo prime. Now it's going to write within the context of that transaction to file F2, and you'll see a modification in foo prime. And now it's going to go ahead and unlink F1, so you see a modification to slash in foo prime, and then that file becomes unlinked. And then it's going to abort. Now, if it hadn't aborted, if it decided to commit, the new file system state would become foo prime. But since it's deciding to abort, it rejects that candidate state, and we go back to the original state foo. So implementing system transactions has sort of been has a long tradition. There are basically two different directions you can go. One direction is make a super portable system that works in user space and is very feasible. The design and the implementation are feasible, so the system has a chance of actually existing. The other direction you can go is optimize for performance and transparency, make it so processes don't even know they're operating within a transactional context. So what we decided, there's sort of a long history of things that we've been looking at leading up to this current work. The first approach that we took was, we'll just take a big database, put it in the kernel, and see if we can build a file system on top of it. That wasn't very transparent because we didn't figure out how to expose that, those semantics to the VFS, and it surprisingly didn't perform too well. Then we decided, well, let's do everything in user space, and we made this crazy monitoring-based transactional file system that used ptrace and signals and all this other stuff, and it didn't have any, very few kernel modifications, if any. We only had like one tiny hack to the kernel, but that didn't have the performance and the transparency we wanted either, so we sort of took the best of the different approaches to those two designs and merged them together to get to our current system, which I'm going to describe to you, Valor. So the transactional model that Valor supports is basically you can dirty a page, append to a file, modify a directory, modify an inode. There may be other operations like making a FIFO or some things like this that we haven't looked at. Supporting these kinds of operations means that you have to support new kinds of locks, directory locks, inode locks, and maybe for performance reasons, intent locks for directory renames. Our isolation is very important. It's a necessary component of the system, and it's discussed more in the paper. Today I'm going to tell you how we transact on dirtying a page, because that seems to be the most performance-critical portion of the system. So one important optimization that we're going to make is that our transactions, our system transactions, are going to be asynchronous by default. They're not durable. You could have them be durable if you wanted to. I think a useful analogy is sort of the file system analogy. You write to the file system. By default, your writes are not durable. If you want them to be durable, you can call fsync and sit there and wait for the page write-back thread to flush those writes to disk. We have a similar system call called T-Sync that does roughly the same thing. And the reason's the same, we want to get that improved performance. But in order to support this, you need to have a page cache where you can stage your writes and batch them together and flush them out at once. So the design of our system is going to basically break down into two big components. The first component is going to be a modification to the page writeback thread, which is going to give us something that we need. It's very important. It's called simple write ordering. And the second thing is we're going to basically implement sort of the textbook undo, redo, write ahead logging transactional manager in a separate kernel module. So just as some quick background, let's take a look at what would happen if you tried to update two pages on the disk without a transaction. The process would come in, and what it wants is it wants both the pages to be updated or none of the pages to be updated, but anything else is bad. So it's going to go ahead and write that first page, and then it's going to go ahead and write that second page, and then something terrible happens, and the system crashes, and you lose all your volatile state, and now you're in a bad state. So the standard solution is, before you write those pages out, you're going to write out these undo redo records, the little yellow blocks that you now see in the legend. And they're going to basically cover you in case something bad happens. They're the information you need to undo any damage. So here's the same scenario again, and then something bad happens. We have enough information now that we can recover that, that incomplete write and roll it forward. OK. Things get complicated, though, when you have a kernel page cache getting in the way of your processes and how they're writing the disk. You might log your undo redo record before you perform your write. So here he is logging his undo redo record like a good process. And then here he is doing his write. But the page cache might not care, and it might write them in the wrong order anyways. And you might find yourself getting into the same situation again where you're flushing the disk and power goes out, and oh no, you don't have enough information to roll back that transaction. So what databases typically do is they take this complicated in-kernel page cache and disk and everything, and they just treat it like a big disk, and they put a disk cache flush on it, which is basically fsync, and they build a new page cache on top of it, and this is a good solution. It's portable, it fits well into the ecology of the Unix model, it's decent. But when you're doing system transactions, it's literally redundant. You already have a page cache specifically designed for file system writes. So we wanted to look at a different solution. So what we did was is we added this Valor device to the page cache. All your undo redo writes go to the Valor device first. And so all undo redo writes go to that device. It, when a page writeback occurs, the undo redo records in that device will get flushed before all the other writes to the rest of the disks. So how does that device work? Well, let's take a look. So here's our disk again, and that's the disk. I'm going to tell you basically about this log module. So the log module consists of a state file, a log file, and two record maps. So this is based off, this is inspired by the transactional file system built on top of the log structured file system that Margo did. So process is going to come by, and it's going to begin a write. Begin a transaction, rather, and it's going to log the undo redo record for that transaction. It's going to perform a write to a regular overwrite-based file system like ext3 or whatever. Now, it's important to note that at this point, we've only been modifying RAM. We haven't touched disk at all. Nothing has hit disk. Now, it's going to perform a page write-back. We're going to flush the log records to our log file. Now, if we were to crash at this point, the state file is going to tell us which record map to recover from. The state file is pointing to the one on the bottom. So we say that the bottom record map is stable, and the one it's not pointing to is unstable. If we were to recover from the stable record map, we'd do nothing. And since we haven't flushed anything to disk yet, that's the right thing to do. Now we're going to update the unstable record map, and it becomes the stable record map. At this point, if we were to crash, we would look at those undo redo pages, and we would check to see if they have been written to disk yet. We'd say, no, they're not, and we wouldn't do anything, so we still wouldn't do anything, and we're still OK. Then we go ahead and we update that unstable record map and flush those pages to disk later on in the PD flush process, the page write-back process for Linux. Now we're going to continue with the transaction. We're going to log some more undo redo records, go ahead and write the corresponding pages, and now we decide to commit. Now it's important to note that the T resolve system call is going to return. the process says, okay, my transaction committed, and it's going to go off and do a whole bunch of things. But the transaction hasn't committed yet, but it is atomic. So that's the model that we're supporting by default. Later on, what's going to happen is page writeback's going to happen, and we're basically going to flush the remainder of the updates to the log file, update that unstable record map. Now, you'll notice that in the bottom right now is this purple commit block. Basically, that's just saying that transaction number one, the transaction process two was doing here, has committed. So if we were to crash at this point, we would still do nothing, because the stable record map says to roll back those three pages. So we still haven't committed yet. Now we update the state file. At this point in time, it says, OK, we've committed transaction one. Let's roll forward pages four and five. So basically, that's our redo operation. And we go ahead and update that unstable record map, flush the rest of the disk. Now, at this point, we can deallocate the space taken by this transaction to log file. One important thing I should point out is that I support extremely long transactions, transactions that take an extremely long period of time. Meanwhile, other transactions could be starting and ending in rapid succession. So we need to allocate blocks in the log file with these record maps to sort of keep track of who still has ends in the fire, so to speak. Now these guys are done. This transaction wants to deallocate its space, so it's going to go ahead and flush negative ones to the record map, to the blocks in the record map it was consuming. And at this point in time, we're going to update the state file, and that effectively unlinks whatever it was using in the log file. We don't have to write over the log file, obviously. And we can update the unstable record map, and we've committed a transaction, then deallocated it. So the reason that the argument that this is atomic stems from basically two big things. We're logging our undo redo records before we dirty pages, and there's different ways in which processes can achieve that depending upon the level of transparency they want. And we use simple write ordering to make sure that our log device gets flushed before everybody else, in addition to some page locking tricks. And finally, we assume that there's some way to write atomically to the disk. So in our hardware, if you write to something which is less than a sector wide, that's atomic. And our state file is less than a sector wide. So we stage everything in the log file, then stage everything in the record map, and then the very last thing we have to do is switch that state file, and the entire file system state transitions from a pre-page write-back state to a post-page write-back state. Our recovery story is pretty much the standard one because our implementation of our logging module is pretty standard. Basically, we're going to reconstruct our state in RAM from our record map, and we're going to go in reverse Ellison order and roll forward committed transactions and roll back aborted transactions. Now, it's necessary that we have been enforcing two-phase locking in our isolation portion of the system, and we have been, and you can read more about that in the paper. Otherwise, you can't recover. So for our evaluation, what we're going to do is we want to support file system workloads. So we're going to do serial transfers and see how we do against asynchronous ext3, just going as fast as it can, doing a big serial write. It's almost unfair. But that's what you have to do if you want to support those kinds of workloads. That's an important workload. We're also going to turn off synchronous transactions for our two other file systems, which were basically implemented as controls. We built effectively a block device on top of Stasis and BerkeleyDB. Now, to turn off synchronous transactions in Stasis, we actually had to break its recovery slightly. But that's because Stasis didn't support write ordering for asynchronous transactions yet. But that's okay. In theory, this is how they would perform if they did support it. The first benchmark we're going to look at is sort of an idealized logging transaction manager. And there's three different configurations. The first is sort of like the only thing it has to do is flush to the log and then flush to the disk. So as you might expect, the overhead on that is going to be roughly twice. Now, if it ever has to checkpoint while flushing, it's going to read those log pages as well as flushing to disk. But the third one is sort of the important one because the log is much smaller than the disk and our RAM is finite and we're going to be incurring seeking while we're using our log. So what we see here is sort of what we expect. The first, this is basically a serial append of a gigabyte's worth of data. And ext3 just belts it out. And our mock Ares implementation, which flushes the same amount of data to a log first, takes almost exactly twice as much time, which is expected. if we incur reads, it's only ever so slightly slower. Those reads are serial, and they were cached from writing them, so. And then finally, when we do our finite case, the extra seeking actually is the thing that's going to cause the most slowdown. So our system gets roughly 35% overhead on top of that lower bound, and an efficient user-level block device that doesn't use B-trees or anything, it's just basically logging undo-redo records for pages just like us, gets a 66% overhead. The majority of its overhead is coming from hitting an in-user space hash table, doing lookups, have I written this page before, have I logged the undo-redo record for this page, and so it's paying for that in its performance. And it gets about 104% overhead on top of the same benchmark. In this benchmark, what we're doing is we're going to look at how basically how quickly can we append a file. And we chose a transaction size of 16 pages. If the transaction size were larger, it would perform roughly the same. The transaction size basically says begin transaction, write 16 pages, commit. Begin transaction, write 16 pages, commit. And just do this until you've done 256 megabytes of overwrite, 512 megabytes of overwrite, and so on. So the x-axis is logarithmic. So these lines are actually linear. And what we see here, our system is getting roughly 2.75 times the speed of ext3, which basically is just paying the cost of writing more data. And our user-level implementation is getting 5 times ext3. And this is consistent with the overheads we saw earlier. And our Berkeley DB-based implementation is getting 23 times. And the reason here is because the Berkeley DB database is really designed for lots and lots of small inserts, and it's really, really optimized for point queries. And this is not the workload it's meant for. In transaction throughput, we're looking at roughly the same thing as before, but now we're going to vary the size of our transactions. So we start off with one-page transactions, then 4, then 16, 64, and 256. And what we're doing here is a gigabyte append. So every single X point does a gigabyte's worth of append. We're getting about 2.9 times ext3. You see we convert, Stasis and Valor converge at roughly 16 pages. Stasis gets 4.2 times ext3, and BDB gets about the same as before. Valor starts to converge at around 16 pages. Stasis at about the same time. And what we're seeing here basically is you're paying the tax of beginning and committing transactions less frequently. Now, BDB actually does have a heel. You can't see it here. Its heel is actually in the sub-page range. I ran the benchmark for smaller page, you know, like 256K and those kinds of things. And there's a tiny little heel. So it converges very quickly on its optimal write performance. So the conclusions that I took from this research are that system transactions are feasible, and they can be given to basically existing file systems with minimal changes to the kernel that already fall in line with its existing design philosophy. And they can you can get system transactions on top of existing file systems with existing data sets. And you can get them with decent overheads compared to what you can expect when you're logging data before writing it. And it requires minimal changes to the existing kernel. So some of the limitations of this work are that because of the way we implement our simple write ordering, our locking is going to slow interleave writes to the same page. That's a problem that could be addressed by freezing pages when people write to them during a page writeback, but we haven't implemented that. Also, some file systems and disks don't fsync when they're asked to. You just have to know, you have to make sure that fsync really works, that when you call fsync, that means the data's on the disk when it returns. That sort of leads into some of our future work. What we want to do is we want to look at the use of a logging device as a coordinator in some kind of transactional disk array or distributed file system, and that might actually be a nice, elegant solution to getting consistent fsync semantics. So that's basically the research, and now I'd like to take questions.
Questions?
Ajay Gulati, I was just wondering, are you doing the dependency resolution between transactions as well? So if transaction 2 has a read after write dependency on transaction 1, will you commit transaction 2 before 1?
So The isolation semantics of the work are discussed in the paper, but basically, yeah, we have two-phase locking in force such that transaction two is going to sit there and wait on transaction one to release the locks before it is allowed to write to those pages. So we have a serializable schedule, but I didn't talk about it in here because, 25 minutes, but yes, we do make sure that there is a serializable schedule of transactions. And it's important for recovery. Recovery doesn't work unless you have that.
Okay, thank you.
Mike Zelik of Equalogic. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the user space and kernel space implementations, particularly what problems you had there?
Yes. So, well, to be fair, we took some of the design concepts of our user space and kernel implementations. So when I say this is a hybrid approach, I mean it's a hybrid approach of the ideas. But if in actual fact you look at it, it's really it's all in kernel space, right? So basically what we learned from our first encounter with the transactional file system KBDB was that the VFS is sort of this big issue. You need to find a way to get transactional so for instance, journaling devices or Berkeley DB, that's just the database we were inserting writes into. Basically, we're using Berkeley DB as a backing store for a file system. Getting that from the block layer through the VFS and the page cache and up to the user level is difficult because you have to deal with cache rollback and those sorts of issues. And also, the performance just wasn't what we wanted because it wasn't optimized for that kind of workload as you saw in our evaluation. So that was the first one. The second one, Amino, we had lots of issues trying to intercept processes. The sad fact is that in today's systems environment, if you want true transparency and you want to write the fewest amount of code and have the system be stable, you really just have to get the privilege of being one of the chosen systems that gets to run inside the kernel. Otherwise, you have to play games with message passing like Fuse does, and you get pretty bad overheads. Fuse can get 2x overhead on top of EXC3 just because of message passing. Or you have to play games with ptrace, or you can't intercept everything, and you have to screw around with libraries. So transparency was an issue there. And then this system, we had to have a simple system to justify getting it into the kernel, but still be transparent so that it would work, have broad coverage.
Christoph Helvig here, and a question about mixing the transactional I.O. with regular POSIX I.O., given that you're integrated in a general purpose kernel. So how do you deal with non-transactional writes getting in the middle of your transaction and transaction causing denial of service type it takes to other processes in the system?
So one of the things that I really wanted to focus on actually was trying to affect as little as possible existing workloads that don't care about transactions and don't want to use them. And you'll notice that if you don't log undo redo records, you're basically using a roughly unmodified page cache. But it is necessary that if you're writing to a transactional volume, that you acquire locks on pages before writing to them in directories. Otherwise, you're going to violate the isolation of transactional processes. So if you've got lots of people in a directory that supports transactional writes, and you've got sort of a heterogeneous workload, the people who aren't transactional are going to suffer some of the locking penalties that they normally would not have suffered if they didn't care. That's one downside. The other downside is, as I described, one of our limitations is if you're writing to hot pages, where basically you're writing to a page in the middle of a page write back, and you're writing to a page in the middle of a page write back, and the transactional process wrote to that page, you have to wait for the page to flush to disk before you're allowed to write to it again, or you'll insert an unlogged update. So that could be resolved by modifying the page cache such that it froze pages. When people did that, like EXT3 does actually does something like that for its journaling block device, but we didn't do that. So I didn't benchmark it in the paper, but I suspect our impact is basically going to be relatively minimal. But if you start writing to the same kinds of directories and throughput's really high, then you might start seeing non-transactional processes pay a slight tax for having to cohabitate with transactional processes.
Margo Seltzer, I'm wearing my Oracle hat at the moment. Did you by any chance use the same block size for Berkeley DB that you did for the file system?
No, I did not. I used a slightly smaller block size for Berkeley DB because there's this implementation detail with overflow pages and how Berkeley DB...
Yeah, so that's completely... Not only is it not a workload for which Berkeley DB is intended, you sort of made sure that you exercised the worst case performance for BerkeleyDB. So what you want to do is actually use large BerkeleyDB page sizes that are at least 4 times larger than your file system block size.
Okay, I mean, so to be fair, I tried to pick a page size that wouldn't cause overflows. And you're right. Yes, and the workload is, I mean, I tried, the BerkeleyDB is really optimized for super fast reads. And, oh, wow. Okay. I mean.
For those who didn't hear that, Margo said, reiterated, it's the worst possible block size choice.
So. Okay. But so to be fair, though, Stasis is a transactional page cache. They don't have a B-tree. When you write to a Stasis, you're writing basically doing serial transfers to disk and logging into redeployed pages as fast as you can in a user space implementation.